begins tax season. Yay! For those of you who are on the ball and got theirs done, you might be wanting to know just how to use your refund in the most effective manner. So let's get a few suggestions from CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
Well, first of all, I just looked up the stats. It's amazing. Two-thirds of people who have filed, so 80 million have filed, about 55 million have gotten tax refunds. And the average refund amount is not small. It's about $3,100. Mm-hmm. So that's real money. And that's average. So many people are getting more. First thing I want you to know is that was a lousy deal you just cut with your Uncle Sam. And the reason is that that means that $3,100 was kept in the government coffers for a full year and you got paid no interest on that. So let's do one thing, like a sort of pinky swear with each other. We don't really want a tax refund. We want you to keep your money throughout the year. So make a change in your withholding or change your quarterly estimates so that you're not getting as big a refund next year. Next up, you got that money. I don't want it to burn a hole in your pocket. So first things first, let's address what I like to call your big three. Make sure you can fund an emergency reserve fund that can cover 6 to 12 months of your living expenses. You got that done, no sweat. Then how about reducing your outstanding credit card debt or any other high interest debt? And number three, fund a retirement plan to the best of your ability, especially, by the way, for a lot of people who have matches at their companies. They're not even using that. So put as much money as you can into retirement. The workplace retirement plan limit this year, $23,000, and an additional $7,500 if you're over the age of 50. You can also consider funding an IRA, a Roth IRA, a backdoor Roth IRA. All these things are really good uses of your money.
Do they also let you buy some of those high interest savings bonds with your refund?
You know, you could. I don't think that's the greatest idea right now. I really don't. I was a huge fan of the I bond early on. But now we're going to see as inflation comes down, the rates on those bonds comes down. I would much prefer people who are really focused on the savings bonds. They tend to be family members who want to help with education. Instead of a savings bond, fund a 529 plan. If you've got kids or grandkids who are bound for college or private high school, this is a plan that is really tax efficient. It's cheap. Make sure that you go through your state's plan. Some states offer tax deductions for 529 plans. Don't buy this through a broker or an advisor. Do it yourself.
As long as you mention the I word, how is inflation doing? And when is the price of a dozen eggs going to start dropping noticeably?
Why do you have to eat eggs? It's bad for you. No, I'm just kidding. So inflation is coming down. It's slowly coming down. Here's the more interesting thing that we're not talking about. And that is that we're going to get an employment report out this week. And for about the fourth or fifth consecutive month, we are going to see that wages are outpacing the rate of inflation. And I think that we're not talking about this. I just got a fascinating report from the Economic Policy Institute. And I only mention this because I was wondering how people are actually doing. And when I looked at the low end, which is really what we're most concerned with, someone who's got, low wages, $28,000, $30,000, these people in the lowest 10th percentile, their wages adjusted for inflation, meaning that if we factor in inflation, these people have seen wages grow by 12.1% between 2019 and 2023.
What?
Yeah. Okay. So that means these people are doing better than inflation. You know, overall inflation, it grew about 20%, right? Since in the 4 years. That's about 4.5% annually. But even with this historically fast inflation, particularly in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic, low-end wages grew substantially faster than price growth. How about that?
We're hearing from CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And while the news about inflation seems good, it's not reflected in the polls, of course. The question is, why not?
I hate to even say this because sometimes what happens is people are like, don't you tell me how I feel. I'm not going to tell you how to feel. I'm just giving you the numbers, okay? And the numbers are so astounding to me. And look, it's not the same for many people. When we talk about this, they say, well, I'm not the lowest end. All right. Okay. So I went and looked at this. This is a huge report that came out from the Economic Policy Institute. And what's fascinating is that, when you look at, yes, of course, the lowest wage earners are doing well. But what about the people in the middle? Even if I look at the middle wage earners, right? If I look at them, they're 3% ahead overall for the 4 years. They're 3% ahead, but they don't feel that way. Hmm. That is how indelible the idea of price spikes can be on our psyches.
Well,
we're not rational. We're human beings. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but really unbelievable, right?
So should people actually look at the amount on their paycheck before they answer the poll questions?
Listen, polling questions are how you feel. So yeah. we know that. But we can look objectively at data and say this is a more informative. Again, look, this is for policies specifically. And, you know, what's really interesting is you often will hear the people complain the most are the people who are really doing the best, like the high wage earners, like they're in the 90th percentile. They make a ton of money. And they're like, it costs me so much money to fill up my Range Rover. Okay. But, you know, even high wage earners, they have not seen big increases in their pay, which is interesting. So the lowest wage workers had the strongest wage growth from 2019 to 2023. And it literally goes, it's like 12% for the 10th percentile, 5% for lower middle, 3% for the middle, 2% for the upper middle, and 0.9% for the high wage earners. Now that's, again, that's just earnings. That's not the fact that their houses went up in value, their retirement accounts went up in value. That doesn't measure that. So to me, what's always interesting about looking at data like this is to understand how this is why the Federal Reserve hates inflation so much, because it sticks in our brains. We're so freaked out by it.
So I guess the key is to take a look at your bank account once in a while, because you may have more money than you thought.
I mean, when you listen to the earnings reports from the big banks, they're saying that people still have a lot of money in their savings and checking accounts. Not everybody. I get it. We always trot out, oh my God, credit card debt is now, you know, $1.1 trillion. I'm the person who says that on the air all the time. And we also need to say, and there are a lot of people who are doing very well.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
You're welcome.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. How do you get rid of belly fat? Let's consult with our favorite cardiac surgeon.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. This is probably one of the most asked questions on the internet. Is there some science that can tell us definitively what works and what doesn't?
Well, Dave, there actually is science. And I'm sorry to say that all those devices that you see for sale on the internet will not actually reduce belly fat on their own. It's really much more complicated than that. First of all, we have to realize that all fat in our body is not bad. And that actually we require fat to maintain good health. It's actually really important that we have fat for our bodies to store excess energy. It keeps us warm, cushions the palms of our hands or the soles of our feet or even our rear ends. So we require fat. But we have two types of fat in our body. We have the fat that lives under our skin, which is known as subcutaneous fat. And that's the sort of cushioning that I'm talking about. But belly fat, the fat that actually lives inside of our abdomen, abdominal fat, or visceral fat, as it's often called, is actually unhealthy. And having excess belly fat is associated with many different diseases. It's also insulin resistant. And so much of the way our fat is distributed in our body is, in fact, genetic. Not 100%, but a huge portion of it is, in fact, genetic. But you can't just use some device or do some exercise to work on just your stomach or your abdomen, and that's going to make your belly fat go down. It doesn't work that way. You basically have to lose fat all over, and you lose it in the reverse order of the way that you stored it.
Last in, first out?
Yeah, basically, just like the stock market.
So you're saying you can't lose abdominal fat just by doing lots of sit-ups and hoping that your abdominal muscles will draw their energy just from the nearby fat?
That's exactly right. Now, if you do a lot of abdominal exercises, you may actually tighten up your abdominal muscles, and that may actually cause some, you know, restriction of your belly's ability to sort of distend or protrude. But that's not really losing fat. If you don't do something to lose overall body fat, you're not going to make any real difference. You may have some small difference in your appearance, but that's not really making you healthier.
Now, you also hear all sorts of extravagant claims about how many pounds per week you can lose through an exercise program. What is a reasonable amount of weight to expect to lose if you're embarking upon one of these programs?
Right. I think that's a wonderful question, actually. Our initial fuel source in our body is a storage form of carbohydrate. And the storage form of carbohydrate is called glycogen. And we store it in our liver and in our muscles and whatnot. And so when you exercise, the first thing you do is you start to break down glycogen because that's our immediate fuel source. Well, your body stores 2.7 grams of water with each gram of glycogen that it stores. So there's a lot of water in it. Probably an expected rate of weight loss after that initial big drop from the glycogen depletion is probably about 2 pounds a week.
So how can you tell when you've moved from that glycogen weight loss to the actual fat weight loss? Do you feel something? Do you feel different?
You know, I think a lot of people actually realize it. Like when they start to diet and they cut their calories, suddenly they find that they're, you know, running to the restroom and urinating quite frequently. And really, that's just them. They've cut their calories. Their body's looking for energy. It goes to the glycogen stores. As it burns it, you lose a lot of water. You know, I think that's what people experience initially. And then as time goes on, the frequency that with which they need to run to the restroom decreases dramatically. Now, in some types of diets, like, for example, a keto diet, where you're actually, you know, restricting carbohydrates almost completely, I mean, those people will lose a lot of weight early on because they deplete their glycogen so fast, and then they get into a state of ketosis. And so they often will experience, you know, a fruity smell to their breath, or they'll have a funny taste in their mouth. Some people get a headache. Some people get dizzy for a few days. But the key thing is they've switched from burning carbohydrate as their primary fuel source to burning fat as their primary fuel source.
But 2 pounds a week is okay. To me, that sounds pretty dramatic, frankly.
Right. I think it's a reasonable goal for people to set for themselves. 600 calories of fat a day is hard, but that will add up to about a couple pounds a week.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Update on the homelessness issue. In early January, volunteers with the nonprofit We Heart Seattle uncovered human remains in a homeless encampment. It was tucked just out of view from a busy Seattle intersection. The body was on city land and had apparently been there long enough to decay down to the bone. We Heart Seattle is wondering why that person's been forgotten for so long and why their volunteers and not city crews were the ones to find the bones. With the report, Cairo News Radio's Sam Campbell.
In a soggy green space tucked between Dexter and 4th Avenue, a team of volunteers find footing on a muddy embankment, grabbing onto tree branches for support as they walk deeper into the small roadside wooded area and toward the remnants of a small encampment. They gather cushions, tents, books, needles, blankets, and keepsakes, all left over, they say, from the camp of a person they found here dead 2 weeks prior.
Checking on the camps, you know, that were still set up, and yeah, I happened to come across a fully decomposed body. It was laying in a tent. He was all fully clothed. He was wrapped up in his blankets and stuff when I pulled him out and had him laying on my knees because I was on my knees pulling stuff out of the tent. And it was a real shock to me. I mean, I've seen a lot of bodies in my time, but seeing one fully decomposed.
Volunteers called the Seattle Police Department to report the death. Officers responded, and the bones are now being examined. With the fluid nature of homeless camp populations and no definitive head count on this camp from any official organization, questions remain on just how many people lived here, who knew this person, and who knows what happened to them. There's no available identification yet from the King County Medical Examiner's Office, leaving a mystery on how this person died and who they were. Some people see the remains forgotten long enough to decompose down to the bone, and they ask, how many more will be found like this person? Those volunteers are members of nonprofit We Heart Seattle. In the absence of verified answers, volunteers act as amateur detectives, piecing together what they can through the debris. Among their findings are glass bottles strung up on branches like ornaments, a veritable library of novels, and enough needles to fill multiple biohazard containers. They conclude in their amateur assessment that this person was likely a voracious reader, with an unbroken taste for decor and a crippling intravenous drug addiction.
He's got his cooker in here.
This is somebody who has a lot of trauma. I don't believe they're one paycheck away from making their rent from getting fired from Boeing or wherever. I believe this is just addiction gets the best of people. They're in a cycle. There's no way a person chooses this way and stays out here to languish and eventually die if drugs are not involved. And the evidence is clear.
Andrea Suarez founded We Heart Seattle during the pandemic and today acts as the nonprofit's executive director. She leads a handful of staff and rotating teams of volunteers in what the website describes as a, quote, action-based boots-on-the-ground movement that organizes trash cleanups in our public spaces and offers resources to those in need.
We've been doing this for 3 years. This is our 330th pick. Over 1 million pounds of trash removed from green spaces and encampments in 3 years with over 11,000 hours of volunteer boots-on-the-ground labor.
But as a private organization operating on public land, some ask, who is We Heart Seattle accountable to? We Heart Seattle isn't officially contracted with any city or government agency. The King County Regional Homelessness Authority and Washington Department of Transportation both say they do not coordinate with Suarez's organization. A spokesperson from Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell's office says in an email that the city does not pay We Heart Seattle for any services. She also writes that it's not a registered volunteer group with Seattle Parks and Recreation. Instead, the nonprofit relies solely on donations, which Suarez estimates is in the $700,000 range this fiscal year. In terms of relationships with local leaders, Suarez previously told Seattle's Morning News on Cairo News Radio that she viewed her actions cleaning up the camps as disruptive to the status quo.
There's some workers working behind you. What are they doing?
They are like in an archaeological dig site, picking up trash from 5, 6 plus 10 years ago. It could be part illegal dumping, part accumulated trash by the people living here. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of used needles, cookers, tourniquets, and other drug paraphernalia that King County hands out through the needle exchange program. So I do question what the term exchange is in that failing program that is really just enabling people to die out here alone.
But now, with 5 of 9 Seattle City Council members being new to the job, Suarez says she's experienced a change in her interactions with some of them.
5 out of the now 8 appointed and elected City Council members have been out here boots on the ground with us, litter picking. Our city attorney's been out here litter picking. Ann Davidson, Sarah Nelson, Rob Saka, Kathy Moore, Bob Kettle came out to an event. So I feel very hopeful that we now have a council that's supporting private funded collaborative efforts that are helping guide them on what's working, what's not, and giving a voice to addicts.
Unlike service providers contracted through King County Regional Homelessness Authority, Suarez said she thinks drug treatment for people suffering from addiction should come before housing.
Needles that are handed out by King County as a form of harm reduction. The current Housing First funding doesn't give money to people who are trying to give people a hand up and path out of addiction. And so We Heart Seattle is using a lot of our donations to fund recovery-oriented housing here forward.
Refusing to commit to prioritizing Housing First has historically left her out of broad homelessness outreach coordination in the county. It's also earned her and We Heart Seattle a contested reputation as either a maverick or a renegade, depending on your views. But it's a reputation that Suarez apparently embraces.
Don't talk to homeless about addiction or recovery, and don't go knocking on their door. They don't knock on your door. And I say, well, isn't that the exact definition of a stigmatizing, is to not acknowledge the person as a human being, that they too might want a clean house, they too might want a clean and sober pathway out? And so for that, I say, let's knock on those tent doors, go within 20 feet, do a welfare check. All hands on deck. Everybody can be an outreach worker.
And Sam is here with us now. Is there a reason that the city couldn't have a program like this?
So, Dave, I've actually reached out to the Seattle Parks and Recreation as well as the mayor's office asking specifically if they had some kind of policy that prevented city crews from going out to this parcel of land at Dexter Avenue and forth, and that would have ultimately resulted in them finding the remains of the body and not these volunteers. So far, I have not received a response from them.
She's been very frustrated, at least with the past city council, which was not in support of her. But it sounds like there's been a little change of heart. Are they okay with the help, or do they still consider her a renegade?
You were right to pick up on the shifting dynamics of interplay between city politics and We Heart Seattle. She was stressing this to me that, you know, historically they have been ostracized and pushed out of coordination, but now it sounds like they are getting a more welcome reception from some of the newer members of Seattle City Council. What that means for the future, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But we do have more coming on this particular feature. We have part two and three of it up on our Cairo News Radio YouTube, and we'll have it up on MyNorthwest.com as well.
Excellent. Cairo News Radio, Sam Campbell. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Dave.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. You might think playing on an NBA team would be the ultimate dream, but Mikal Bridges of the Brooklyn Nets has his sights on a different dream. CBS's Caitlin O'Kane has more.
For most basketball players, making it to the NBA is the ultimate dream. But Brooklyn Nets star Mikal Bridges has another dream as well.
My other dream was being a second grade teacher. I think just helping kids has always been a big thing of mine.
Why second grade?
Because I loved second grade when I was young. I feel like that was one of the years I really remember, and just having a great year. I had a great teacher named Miss Porter, and I just feel like I always loved second grade.
Mrs. Porter inspired Mikal to follow that dream, and he got to do that at PS 134 in Brooklyn, working as a teacher for a day.
Yeah. You guys ready for number two?
The Nets got in around 1:30 a.m. the night before after beating the Cleveland Cavaliers 120-101. The player had a long night, but he was committed to teaching those kids.
You pass. And their energy kind of just was like, just got me going so fast. Like, they just was excited, and they were teaching me. It was on a little xylophone. I don't know what I was doing with the little, you know, what the teacher was teaching. The kids next to me was like pointing at the board, like, follow that. I'm like, oh, and I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So,
thanks, guys. Woo!
He also went to recess and lunch, and he taught his favorite class, math, where perhaps his inclination for teaching others began.
Math came easy to me. I feel like I was probably one of the smartest math kids in our class, so I was never like, somebody get it wrong, and I'm like, oh, you don't know math, you know? But like, I'll try to teach them, but oh, well, this is how I learned it, and it's pretty simple to me this way. Just think of this way, you know?
Mikal practices free throw shots on Monday. He gets 25 free throw shots. He practices on Tuesday and gets 10 more free throw shots. How many free throw shots did he get on Tuesday?
The kids couldn't get enough of their temporary teacher, Mr. Bridges.
Can I hug you?
Yeah, you want a hug? What's up, my guy? You want a hug?
While meeting an NBA star is a kid's dream, meeting these kids fulfilled a dream for him.
You know, a lot of days we're in school, you know, and with our teachers, and they, I think they just don't get enough credit, you know, because we're around them a lot, you know what I'm saying? And they help us, you know, become better people every day, and I think some of these overlook a little bit.
That is Caitlin O'Kane reporting.
And now here he is from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9. G. Scott. So the men's Final Four is set.
Sorry.
And what's the matter?
Yeah, it is hot.
Y'all in here sweating.
It's too hot for you?
It's hot. Did you talk to people how hot it is in here?
Our HVAC is broken or something.
Man!
Yeah.
I'm supposed to, y'all supposed to do the news around here like this?
It's too hot for you?
Ooh, Lord!
Is that your problem?
Mm-hmm.
It's fine for us. We do it every morning.
finish the words. It's getting hot in here.
Mm-hmm.
What does Nelly say after that?
So Nelly? So take off all your clothes.
Oh, so take off all your clothes.
Yeah.
See? He knows.
Okay.
There's a drop for future reference.
Okay. Okay, go ahead. Let's get to the news, Dave.
Yeah. What is the news? So, Final Four for the men. What are the women up to?
Women's basketball is the biggest storyline of the tournament. It is, Colleen. Right now, women's basketball, it's been here. Of course, it's been here. We've all watched it. It's bigger now than ever, and you all have your opportunity to say, I remember when. Well, tonight, today at 4 p.m. It's going to be the rematch of last year's national championship game.
That's right.
Iowa against LSU. Superstars Angel Reese for LSU against Caitlin Clark for Iowa. And then after that game at 6 o'clock is going to be USC versus UConn. Two superstars there. Juju Watkins for USC. Paige Buckner for UConn. It is appointment TV, y'all. All of the homies in the text thread. Never, ever has it, y'all, what you doing later? Hey, y'all want to get together?
Yeah.
Like, are going to watch women's basketball.
Good.
This is the beginning. The same way I would assume that all of my father and all of his partners back in the day in the 80s was talking about Magic Johnson and Larry Bird as they entered into the NBA. This is where we are right now for women's basketball. It is getting ready to take off.
What do you think changed?
NIL. NIL and the fact that Nike was able to get behind these efforts. Like, now the women are able to make money. Now they're able to go out there and make money off of their image. Nike had a huge commercial on Caitlin Clark now. Huge. They've had huge commercials on Angel Reese. Yeah. NIL has changed.
So it sounds like the more we promote these women, the more we promote these teams, the more people want to watch them. So it's not that people don't want to watch, is that they just didn't know they could.
Huh.
That was like the chicken and egg argument years ago.
You want stars. You've got them.
Well, no, we've always had stars. They just weren't promoted as such.
Bingo. I have always had stars.
Absolutely.
Lisa Leslie.
Women didn't just get good at basketball.
Right? Like, you've always had stars. Cheryl Miller, who scored 100 points in a game. I mean, like, there's always been stars. So what you have now, Dave, is you have NIL with the collaboration with social media. Right? Those two things are all big. And now we all see that now. We all can see this game. And I'm just telling you, I got to say, these stars are really playing up into it. Because, again, right now, women's basketball, tonight, you're going to have four superstars that you're going to get to see. And these are household names now. And it's just beautiful to see. Because I remember there used to be, well, the reason why nobody watches the women's game is because it's just not that good, right?
Yeah.
It is the same game being played as 20, 30, 40. It's the same game.
Yeah.
The only difference is, like Colleen said, oh, we get to see more of it now and more people are talking about it now. I don't know. I just am really excited about it and really excited, but not just me. Amongst my peers, this is the biggest discussion. It's bigger than men's basketball for college, and it's bigger than the NBA. Like, this is the storyline. Right?
So the key to ending discrimination is just popularity. Because if you can make money at it, you're not going to shut women out.
That's right. Yeah,
yes.
I suppose.
You got it. You got it. But it's still hot in here.
Yeah,
it is. I know. I'm sweating.
We can take it.
Yes.
We're built a stronger stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Dave,
yes.
Real quick before we go, I got 20 seconds. How was your weekend, brother?
My weekend was great.
Yeah, what'd you do? Did you do anything exciting? Did you get in the yard? Did you go for a walk? Did you go to an opera?
We went to the ballet. We saw Harold and the Purple Crayon with our daughter, our granddaughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Harold still has his purple crayon.
They made a ballet out of that?
Yes, they did. Amazingly. Very,
wow.
Very well done with the graphics, and the crayon appears and the moon appears and people fly in the balloon, even though it's just graphics. It was very well done.
Sweet.
When was the last time you were at the ballet?
What?
I said, when was the last time that you, G. Scott, were at the ballet?
Never Rary 31st.
I just wanted to check.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And joining us now from the King County Prosecutor's Office is their communications spokesman, Casey McNerthney. And we have an update on some burglary charges from the east side. This is in Kirkland?
Yeah, Kirkland and Redmond and Bellevue. Last week, there were five people who were charged with multiple different residential burglaries, and some also had charges of possession of stolen property. Kirkland police were the lead agency, but as we were saying, this also affected Bellevue and Redmond and also Linwood up in Snohomish County. What police allege is that folks from this group came up to the east side from California to commit these crimes, which is, they're not sure why that was the case, but that may come out during the court proceedings. There was also something else interesting that Eric Karp, who's the sergeant for Kirkland Police, mentioned. Here's him talking to Como about the case.
The suspects actually carried handheld devices. We refer to them as jammers. And that actually confuses like Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and radio signals in a short range. And so many of the surveillance systems that we were able to look at actually had a residence that would have their surveillance system kind of go either blurry or get pixelated.
Despite all that, police were able to find them when a camera and a witness saw three suspects and the license plate of a rental vehicle associated with a home burglary in Kirkland.
So they come here from California and they're equipped with jammers that are designed to defeat security systems?
That's what police say. And
yikes.
Yeah. And if you're like me, the first thing you do is you Google, will my Ring camera not work if somebody has a Wi-Fi jammer? And the short answer is this. If you have a strong network password for your Wi-Fi, you'll probably be okay. And also, don't lose sleep over it, because there's always going to be someone who tries to get around technology and certainly home security, but police are on this one. And I think this case is a good example of what you see. You know, even if you allegedly have somebody with a jammer, between these five defendants, they're now facing a combined 25 charges. And those are all felony charges.
All felonies, okay.
If you're going to make the bet that a Wi-Fi jammer will keep you out of court, that's not a safe bet.
Okay, so they stand to be in jail for a while.
If convicted, yes.
Yes. All right, we had a homicide case last September near 25th Avenue and East Union Street in the Central District. We know more about that now?
Yeah, we do. You know, and this was a case that very briefly made the news. And sometimes people wonder, you know, is there any follow-up on these cases? And there is. Certainly it's not forgotten by Seattle police or by prosecutors who were at the scene and the autopsy that followed it. But last week, a Renton man was charged with murder in the second degree, and we asked that he be held on $3 million bail, and the court agreed to that. The circumstances, what police say is that this was a dispute over $60 and a scooter, according to a couple of witnesses. And so
$60 and a scooter.
Right. Hmm. And I'm sure that there will be more that comes out as the case moves forward, and we'll see if that holds up. But either way, it's just a really tragic case. And this is a good point to highlight that our crime strategies unit looks at every homicide case and every incident of shots fired. And their report, for now that we're through March, for the first 3 months of 2024, will be coming out soon. So I'll have that for you as soon as we have that and see what the trends around shooting say, to see if there's an increase or decrease or if it's the same. And then compare that to last year, too.
The really good news this morning is that we may have licked the catalytic converter theft problem.
Yes, and a big thank you to you on this segment. It was really Cairo's Morning News and the Seattle Times editorial board that kept this in the minds of lawmakers, you know, on the media side, at least. This was something that Gary Ernstorf, a senior prosecutor in King County, worked on for years and really kept on saying, if you want to address effectively a catalytic converter theft, the way to do it is going after the people who are illegally buying them. Here's Governor Jay Inslee at the bill signing last week.
It helps address the increase in catalytic converter thefts seen in recent years. It clarifies what licenses are required for and narrows the scope of who can handle catalytic converter transactions. It also establishes new felony and gross misdemeanor crimes for trafficking in, possessing, selling, or offering to sell catalytic converters, or intentionally changing the vehicle identification number on a detached catalytic converter.
So what this does is create inspections, which a lot of people thought were happening already, but they weren't.
Right. That came out clearly in some of the segments that we did, that they said, okay, you should have inspections, but nobody followed up on it.
Right. And now there are those inspections, and if people who are buying scrap metal improperly are caught, it's at least $1,000 as a fine, and more in some cases. And so Gary Ernstorf, who really pushed this over and over and over, here's him explaining who it addresses.
This bill targets those unlicensed individuals who are out there buying and selling used or stolen catalytic converters every day. So this burdens the thief, not the upstanding business persons, the persons in our community.
It will take a little bit, but I think what we're going to see is over 6 months and 12 months and 18 months, we're going to see those numbers drop off until the problem is not at all what it was a year or two ago.
So in a few months, you'll be back here saying that we had zero catalytic converter thefts.
Well, maybe not zero, but hopefully close to zero. Either way, we're going to keep an eye on it to see if that works out. And if there's another loophole, we'll just close that one too.
Excellent. Casey McNerthly from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you, Casey.
A great seat, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.